Hello listeners, and welcome to issue 232 of the Sudbury News Talk magazine. I'm Julie Thompson, and this edition is my presenting premiere, so I promise you lots of alliteration, hopefully without hesitation, deviation or repetition. Well, we've made it through Halloween and bonfire night, but it still feels too early to mention the C word, even though the shops are already stocked up on that time of year produce. That's not to say there won't be a few references throughout this broadcast. As our regular listeners will know, and our new listeners may not, in addition to presenting the magazine, it's my privilege to select the subject. And whilst this might sound an easy task, I can assure you it is not. So if you have any suggestions for future themes, why not pop a note inside your return envelope, and future presenters will have a few suggestions in the bag to choose from. So here's my choice of subject, inspired by a walk through the airport duty-free shops or past the fish and chip shop on Friday evening. Yes, it's fragrance. Our first contributor this time is Paula Short.
To talk about fashion being life-changing seems to be rather shallow, but there is an exhibition currently showing at the V&A Museum honouring a woman who achieved just that, both for herself and other women. Gabrielle Bonheur Chanel, as she was christened, had an unsteady start in life when, at the age of 11, she and her sisters were sent to a convent following the premature death of their mother. Dropped off by horse and cart at the convent by their father, he practically disappeared from their lives thereafter. A life of hard work, self-discipline and sewing was offered by the nuns, culminating in Chanel coining the phrase, "My life didn't please me, so I created my own life." So after working in a draper's shop, she got a solo singing slot in a local nightclub where she acquired the nickname Coco and eventually turned her hand to decorating straw boaters. Not in the flamboyant style which was the fashion of the day, but with a single flower, a pretty ribbon. Women love their simplicity. Around this time, she met the love of her life, an Englishman named Arthur Capel. With his encouragement, she moved from hats into clothes. World War I had just begun, and she used the austerity of the war to her advantage, in direct contrast to the tight, corseted dresses which had been fashionable. It was shorter clothes for slimmer women, loose-fitting and comfortable. They gave women the freedom to work as they chose, in particular for the war effort. By day, they could drive an ambulance or a truck, and by night, just add a string of pearls to go out to dinner. When Capel was killed in a car accident, she was devastated. But he left her memories, an emotional void, and £40,000, which she used to buy the premises at 21 Rue Cambon, now known as the House of Chanel. She was now an established couturière. But never one to sit on her laurels, she turned her thoughts to a new venture. She wanted to produce a signature perfume. She hired a chemist called Beau with the instructions to produce a perfume which got away from the delicate flowery smells common at that time. She said, "I am an artisan, so I want a perfume that is composed, a paradox." It was quite a task, but Beau followed his instructions to the letter and, job completed, he presented her with 5 or 6 bottles of liquid. Picture the scene. Beau must have waited in some trepidation as Chanel was smelling her way along the bottles until she picked up one which brought a smile to her face. Beau breathed a sigh of relief. Now to choose a name. Chanel considered 5 her lucky number as she had always released her new collection on the 5th day of the 5th month. No problem then. it would be Chanel No. 5. Then there was the packaging. In her inimitable style, she kept it simple. A plain white box edged in black. Let the perfume speak for itself. Needing financial backing, she was put in touch with the brothers Paul and Pierre Wertheimer. All was well for a while until she realised they were making a fortune while she was just getting a 10% retention fee. Inevitably, she challenged them on this arrangement, threatening to produce a new perfume. The brothers had spent a lot of money on advertising and promotion, so went to her solicitor and asked, "What does she want?" She emerged with a pleasing settlement. After all, the wily Mademoiselle Chanel had no need to spend on advertising. She got the best recommendation of all when someone asked Marilyn Monroe what she wore in bed. She famously replied, "Chanel No. 5. I have a story of some embarrassment myself. As a young girl, a grateful boss brought me a small bottle of concentrated Chanel No. 5. I was so in awe of this gift, I kept it on a shelf, just picking it up from time to time, only to find one day it had evaporated. I learned my lesson the hard way, remembering Chanel's prediction. Perfume is the unseen, unforgettable, ultimate accessory of fashion. It heralds your arrival and prolongs your departure." Chanel said of herself, "I'm just a little dressmaker trying to make women look pretty," but she was so much more. She changed the way women felt about themselves. So if you can't afford the clothes, treat yourself to a bottle of Chanel No. 5. It may not prove to be lucky in the way it was for Coco, but it will surely make you feel good.
3.
What a fabulous first article, and what great words of advice. Perhaps we should all ask for a bottle for the C word we're trying to avoid. I loved Paula's words. Perfume is the unseen, unforgettable, ultimate accessory. It seems I'm not the only one who likes alliteration. Next is Wayne Robinson with his thoughts on fragrances, a trip down memory lane.
The olfactory system is a wonderful thing. On average, the human nose can detect around 3,000 odorants, which means that we can define up to 3,000 different smells. This also means that our systems have limits and explains why, sometimes, very different things smell alike. An example of this for me is Lapsang Souchong tea. To me, it smells exactly the same as creosote, but to a dog with a much more highly refined system able to identify 10,000 times more than humans can, it would be totally different. I think my sense of smell is quite good. When we bought our first old Victorian house, I recall once smelling gas in our understairs cupboard and calling out the emergency gas team to check it out. When the engineer came to the house, he couldn't detect it until he got his meter out and then congratulated me on catching a small leak early. Different smells always invoke memories. As a child, I remember playing with my cousins outside when we used to visit my grandparents in North London. My granddad and uncles would be in the pub on the corner and would pop out periodically with a glass of pop or a packet of crisps. When the door opened, it had that mixed scent of beer, cigarettes, and somehow a welcoming feeling of warmth and friendship. Can a scent actually feel warm and friendly? Come to think of it, yes. Different fragrances can trigger different emotions, so I suppose that's where the link lies. The scent of a flower can take me to a funeral, a wedding, or another event in life that I've attended. Perfume or aftershave is a very personal thing, and so it makes us think of people in our past that used to wear it, or of an era in which we lived when it was popular. I could define most stages of my life by aftershaves. In my early teens, during the 1970s, my first was Brut 33. My mates all wore it too, but as we grew up, we went through many different ones, all with their own distinctive fragrance. I can still recall the scent of many of them now. How many do you remember from these? Old Spice, High Karate, Blue Stratus, Tabac, Denim, we wore them all. In the 1980s, there seemed to be an even greater choice available, and being a little older and able to afford a bit more, I ventured into the more expensive aftershaves. Who remembers Aramis? Not a favourite of mine personally, but very popular at the time. What about Paco Rabanne? Hugo Boss? Davidoff Coolwater? Dracar Noir? Mandate? Givenchy? Many of these are still available today, which is surprising, but I suppose men are creatures of habit, so there's still a market for old fragrances. In the 1990s, it was Calvin Klein 1, Tommy Hilfiger, Versace Blue Jeans, Dupe, Jean-Paul Gaultier Le Male, and Ralph Lauren's Polo. It must have been about the 1990s that I became a creature of habit too, as I seem to have stuck with the Jean-Paul Gaultier as my go-to scent. That's just made me realise that I've become an old fogey. It just kind of creeps up on you. Many memories are invoked by recognising smells. Just a whiff or two of two-stroke oil instantly takes me back to my motorcycling days when I was in my late teens. All two-stroke oils are great, but Castrol R was by far the best. Many years ago, as a milk boy, I would work Sunday mornings, and the aroma of fried breakfast cooking as I went door to door was mouth-watering. The smell of bacon cooking never fails to make me hungry, and I often think back to those days, especially that long hot summer of 1976 when I worked all through the summer holidays. Likewise with Indian food, there's something alluring about the smell of all the herbs and spices used in the cooking. My godmother, Yvonne, was a Christian Indian, and she taught my mum how to cook fruity Indian dishes. When I smell Indian food, I'm instantly transported back to childhood days playing with Bimbo, who was my godmother's son. Does that make him my godbrother? I haven't had contact with them for many years and often wonder what happened to them. Different drinks have the same effect. The smell of dark rum always takes me back to one particular evening of overindulgence in my early 20s, which made me vow never to drink the stuff again. I've managed to keep that vow. Of all the smells I've encountered, my favourite two are the smell of freshly baked bread and fresh coffee. I don't know of anybody who's ever complained about the smell of freshly baked bread. And the smell when opening a fresh foil wrap packet of coffee is absolute heaven. We have a grinder at home, and I just love sitting and grinding beans just to experience the intense aroma it gives off. It's such a shame that it never seems to taste quite as good as it smells. That transports me back as well. The first time I ever smelt filter coffee was at primary school when I walked past the staff room as a teacher was walking out the door. Funny how that smell has the power to take me back to being a five-year-old walking along that strange part-tiled Victorian corridor. So, smelling familiar fragrances really can trigger a trip down memory lane. What a powerful sense that is.
Thank you, Wayne. When I suggested this subject, I had no idea of the far-reaching effects that smell can have on our lives. I was particularly impressed with your gas-smelling ability, and now I know what aftershave to buy for you for the C-word we're not going to mention. You may recall that News Talk stalwart John Chambers, quizmaster extraordinaire, hung up his quiz book in our last edition, so I'm excited to let you know that the marvellous Michelle Mandry has risen to the challenge and has written a seasonal set for you to solve. Over to Michelle.
Hello, I'm just going to go straight in with question one. In traditional occupations, what did a cooper make? Question two. Working holiday, paid volunteer, and same difference are all examples of what type of speech? Question three. The gunpowder plot took place in November of which year? Question number four. A tea blend flavoured with bergamot oil is named after which British Prime Minister? Question five, true or false? A typical cloud weighs around a ton. Question 6. Which building in East Anglia is known as the Ship of the Fens? Question 7. Which book by Thomas Hardy features the raucous Mel Stock Choir Christmas carolling at their neighbours' doors? Question 8. A tiny village in West Wales has the same name as a town that features in the Nativity story. What name do they share? Question 9. In the song Winter Wonderland, what is the snowman called? And question 10. King Rat is a villain in which pantomime?
Thank you, Michelle. Just one mention of the C word by my reckoning. We'll hear the answers later on. Let's hear from Margaret King with her fragrances, A Summer Memory.
The following short passage, based upon my summer memories of certain fragrances, is written as something of a valediction. The house in question, which we visited many times, was sold this year, so just the memories remain. Fragrances, A Summer Memory. The walk from the house seemed long, but it was very flat. The quiet country road wound through the lovely plain of Dauphin, the Provençal medieval hilltop village, which stood proudly some distance away, as it had done for centuries. As we turned onto the long, straight section of the track stretching in front of us, we could not help but look up at the beautiful village. Out of necessity and tradition, the journey had to take place early in the day. 7:30 was the ideal time, and doubly advantageous as the later intense summer heat was then avoided. To our right, we passed the pristine football pitch. Its bright green manicured grass kept regularly watered by either overground or underground methods. And now it was virtually gleaming beside the dry, parched and yellowing Provençal landscape. Opposite, as ever, in the large field were the two or three horses grazing nonchalantly among the sweet-smelling hay. Well ahead, over the main road, we could clearly see in the sunlight the neighbouring hilltop village of St. Maime and its crowning glory, the ruined castle. We already knew the most famous part of its history, the tale of Les Quatre Riennes. The Count, who lived there during the 13th century, fathered, sadly for those days, only a progeny of four girls. However, not to be outdone, he contrived to marry each one off to a European king. Daughter Eleanor became the wife of our very own king, Henry III, and the mother of the future King Edward I, better remembered as the infamous Hammer of the Scots. We knew we were not going to take the stiff climb up to the castle this morning. Instead, as we continued along our way, a friendly dog ambled out to greet us. At last, we reached the ancient bridge, crossed over and turned right to walk along the side of the dry riverbed. The road was dusty and well used. A group of buildings loomed closer. Only then did the smell of strong, freshly brewed coffee overwhelm us. The French workmen did not disappoint, as the regular early morning huddle sat outside the tables of the patisserie, their cups steaming before them. But as we pushed open the door, an even more potent, delicious, but utterly unique fragrance hit the nostrils. The smell of freshly baked, crusty bread. As always, the baker had risen very early, and as always, he never disappoints. We admire the array of loaves while luxuriating in the aroma. We place our order. Even the schoolgirl French was instantly understood. De baguette, de croissant, et trois pains au chocolat, s'il vous plaît, madame. Merci. Breakfast is on its way.
Thank you, Margaret. That was so evocative of Provence. I almost felt that I was there. And you're right. And just like Wayne said, the smell of baking bread is very hard to resist. Despite moving out of the area, Ken Watkins is always ready, willing and able to let us have a story, whatever the subject, and this edition is no exception.
It was my wife's birthday recently, and I faced the annual challenge of what to get to mark the occasion. I learned very early on in our relationship that perfume was out of the question, as it always triggered a migraine. At least I had time to think about that, as our first date was a few days before her 20th birthday, so I got away with just a card. But Christmas, a couple of months later, provided the first of those annual head-scratching moments. As we were at university at the time, and not exactly flush with money, I settled for a book token, which was well received. And book tokens or other gift cards have remained, as a fail-safe, near the top of my shopping list for birthday and Christmas ever since. But not every year, I hasten to add. This year, I didn't have to think about a birthday present. I was told we were going to an evening of music, two acts, a blues singer and a folk singer. All I had to do was drive down to the venue in Barry, as Judy had booked the tickets. In keeping with the fact that my wife is Welsh and Welsh-speaking, most of the lyrics were in Welsh, with brief bursts of English in between numbers. But I had an interpreter, the birthday girl, sitting next to me when a little translation was needed. Fragrances have always proved a challenge for Judy. Department stores tend to put cosmetics next to the entrance, so we always move through those areas at speed. Travelling by train has also occasionally necessitated moving to a different carriage, and sometimes it can be a long walk. So indulge me then, if, rather than talk about fragrances, I concentrate on aromas, or should I call them smells? Some of them delightful, some best avoided. Several years ago, we lived in Banbury when I worked on the local paper there. To the north of the town, there was a food factory, which included coffee and custard powder among its products. And if the wind was in the right direction, the smell was delightful. To the south of the town, there was a pig farm, and there was never any doubt as to which way the wind was blowing when you left the house in the morning. Banbury also had a small abattoir, which my daughter and I hurried past on our 20-minute Saturday morning walk to the town centre. Fortunately, further along the journey, there was a bakery with delightful, enticing aromas. Did they draw us into the shop to buy bread and donuts? You bet they did. Supermarket bakeries have the same magic pull. Go in at the right time, and the aroma is overwhelmingly tempting. But having deliberately chosen to shed some weight this year, I simply stand and only breathe it in. Well, most of the time anyway. One of the best summer jobs I had as a student was working at a bakery in Coventry. 2 weeks on days, 2 weeks on nights took a bit of getting used to, and it was, inevitably, very hot work. But the smell, wonderful every minute of the shift. And you got to taste some of the goods if they came out of the oven slightly imperfect, as well as a free loaf, which was usually still warm, to take home after work. Before moving to Wales in 2020, we'd lived in Suffolk for 35 years, initially in Acton, a village which had a dairy farm on the outskirts, and which certainly added to the rich mix of aromas that rural areas inevitably produce. The herd is long gone, but I'm reminded of it any time we get out into the countryside over here in Wales, where livestock, rather than arable, is the order of the day. When I retired, we were living in Alfeaton, and as it was then just the two of us, we decided to downsize and put our cottage, with 2 acres of land, up for sale. A prospective purchaser couple turned up on the day the local farmer had been muck-spreading, and unfortunately the wind was in the wrong direction. "The village smells," was their furious reaction, and my attempt to explain that the aroma was short-lived was simply brushed off. They went, and one day later, so did the smell.
Three.
Ah, yes, the aroma of the countryside. Thank you, Ken, for sharing your fragrant thoughts. Have you noticed there's definitely a pattern emerging with News Talk contributors and their love of bakeries? Jenny Finch, our constant and capable contributor, has 20 years of articles under her belt. Read by Ruth Salisbury Higgs, let's hear Jenny's thoughts.
Perfume, or perhaps the accepted title used by the luxury products industry, fragrance. What does that word bring to mind? Flowers, jasmine, heady, sweet-smelling tropical fruits, delightful, aromatic essential oils, luxury, or perhaps just a few lovely memories. You can even conjure up something of this just by saying the word. Well, anyway, some of us can. We're encouraged by the glossy magazines and the advertisements to adopt, and I quote, your statement fragrance. You can see women and men wandering around the perfume counters in the department stores, trying out different perfumes from the testers, and then walking away with thoughtful expressions on their faces. Do I like that? No, they're thinking, it actually reminds me of that woman who interviewed me for the job I'd really set my heart on and then offered it to someone else. Or, I think I like that. Doesn't my friend Doris wear it? But on second thoughts, perhaps not. It's actually more shower gel than expensive French perfume. Or, oh, definitely not. My old maths teacher used to smell of that. Horrible. All this adds up to the same thing. Scent and aromas affect our perceptions and our memories differently. Did you know, and I didn't till I started reading up on it, babies and very young children actually have a very keen sense of smell, without any of the preconceived impressions that can bring. The infant makes no judgments based on smell or scent, other than perhaps the reassuring and special smell of mum or dad, and aren't at all bothered if mum or dad hadn't showered that morning. For animals, smell is especially important. A dog uses his nose, we are told, to identify friend, foe, food, and fear. We once had a dog who, despite having a very sweet nature, had a deep-seated loathing of being bathed. On the few occasions we had no choice but to subject her to this torture, she would stand rigid with a look of pained disgust on her whiskery face and be shampooed with what was described on the bottle as a pleasant herbal shampoo designed to be acceptable to your dog. Nevertheless, the moment she was released from this undignified experience, would streak off and find something that had recently died and now lay gently rotting in the undergrowth, and would roll in it, returning with a look of deep satisfaction that, had we been able to read her little canine mind, undoubtedly would be thinking, thank goodness, got rid of that obnoxious smell of herbal dog stuff at last. This smell of dead rat is so much nicer. Perfume and smell can be different things, not only to dogs, but to us humans too. Even those smells that are supposed to be lovely are to others quite horrible. I can't stand the smell of burnt toast, or honey for that matter, which, considering it's supposed to be good and natural, to me smells anything but. On the other hand, do you remember the smell of hot road tar? Now, If that could be bottled and sold, I'd buy it. Intoxicating, and a great shame it's no longer used anymore. Perhaps I'm just living in a distant era, or even worse, losing my sense of smell. Both thoughts would be rather depressing, but for the fact you only have to open your window on the morning of a lovely day in early June, and if you can ignore the smells of last night's barbecue, just breathe in that scent of newly mown grass, damp earth, and that unforgettable something that can only be the scent of an English summer day. Something else they haven't successfully managed to bottle yet.
Thank you, Ruth, for sharing Jenny's article with us. Another example of alliteration, friend, foe, food and fear. And I couldn't help but laugh when your dog preferred odour de dead rat. Now, we love a special guest here at Sudbury News Talk, and this evening we have the pleasure of hearing from Sue Tibbetts, who's the chair of the Sudbury Ephemeral Society. This is an organisation I hold in the highest esteem for the very important work they do, but let me hand over to Sue, who can tell you all about it.
Good evening. Well, I can't say that I can contribute much to smell with this item, because even our documents aren't really musty. The Sudbury Ephemera Archive was an idea conceived by the late Andrew Phillips and the Reverend Tony Moore. It's possibly the only paper ephemera archive in the country. The National Ephemeral Archive collection doesn't take paper, it takes items. So what do I mean by ephemeral? Well, we're referring to the papers that are normally shredded, burnt or thrown away. Today we live in an increasingly paperless society. Communications are more and more in the form of emails. I went to the mobile cinema last week, and in the Kingfisher car park, where the lorry stood, I took up to the steps my ticket. It wasn't a paper ticket, it was on my telephone. I'd only just booked the actual ticket anyway, literally as I came out of the door, and it didn't seem that I had time to print it off. Yet in the archive, one of our early donations was one of those tickets that came out of the silver ticket machine in the old Gainsborough cinema. And with it is a programme for the same film. Things that we forget about. So often, people either have no experience of things that happened 50 years ago, and I had this example with a young colleague who telling the class that the great big heavy hot water bottle, as I knew it was just a bottle used in the war for collecting water in case there was a shortage. She'd forgot, didn't have any idea that it was something that you put in your bed to warm it and could easily burn yourself or hit your toe on it. And ouch, that hurt. Some papers are interesting from the design point of view. They are the earliest posters which we have. Some were printed professionally in just straight, heavy black ink from the local printers. Others hand-drawn by an amateur. Now computer-generated and designed at home by our own computers is how we advertise local events. We get inquiries from all over the world about people's friends and relatives. Now, an interesting part of our collection is a group of family papers. I was waiting in Bury St Edmunds on a cold winter's afternoon. In fact, it had been snowing, despite being March. And I had a phone call. It was from a lady who lived in Cheltenham. She spoke as if she'd been in touch with me before, but I don't think she had. She told me she was the last survivor of her family, and she didn't want her family papers to be just in the hands of a solicitor or whoever went to empty her house after she died and destroyed. so she wanted to bring them back to Suffolk, where her family had come from. I agreed and said, yes, please. In fact, the papers were not wanted by the Regimental Museum in Bury, nor did Bury Archive want them, so we have the collection. A collection that takes us back, when you look at the census, to the 1600s, to Bures, to Waldingfield, to a postman who delivered papers in local villages, and to a grave at Chilton Church. Recently, the people who work as volunteers for the archive worked with, during COVID, the Suffolk Archives on Suffolk Stories. And we were looking at Sudbury Market. Unfortunately, it was during the pandemic and not many people wanted to stop and talk to us, which put a bit of the kibosh on this project. But there still is the Suffolk Stories project online under the County Archive site. We have helped students with projects, authors with background research. It is a new research approach to learn about family homes. And we fortunately have got the papers from a local estate agent, Mr. Turner in Friar Street, which later became Thornton's. When the estate agent closed, we were given all of the papers that existed in their office. So we have details about the sales of houses in the town and the resale of those houses. We have details about the size of the rooms. So if anybody wants to know about the weavers' houses in Inkerman Row, we can tell you the size of each room. Love to have a model made of them one day. Our team is very interested in local history and they have diverse expertise, which is brilliant because two members are now looking through the town archives, which have come under our care, and finding the various wills and information about properties exceedingly interesting. We've also been fortunate to receive some of the papers from the friendly societies like the Shepherds and the Buffaloes. We'd love to have more, like members of the Foresters. These were the papers that helped so many families before the days of the National Health Service and Social Security, when people depended on paying their subscriptions to help them in times when they couldn't work through illness and such like. Occasionally, such papers appear after more than years after the person died. We have a local historian who died long before this society began, 10 years ago. My first request was, what happened to her papers? Nobody could tell me. We asked around, we had various suggestions. Suddenly, last year, information came our way that her papers are safe and sound, and we look forward to looking through them in the new year. We treat all inquiries very seriously, and if we cannot answer a question, we usually know who to pass the inquiry on to. We never allow papers to be taken from the archive, but will copy anything for people and research a subject to supply the answer if a person is unable to do so themselves. The collection includes timetables, letters, menus, programmes, adverts, as well as photographs, which we share with the photo archive. Now, one of the funniest pieces that I will end with was a piece about a family letter that came our way via the police, the Essex police. They sent an envelope into the town clerk, who passed it on to us. It had been lost property. There were several letters and a lock of hair. I was talking at a local history group last year, and a lady came in to us some months later saying, I've looked through your catalogue and you've got some papers about my family, I believe. When we showed them to her, she was very, very surprised that they should include her great-great-grandmother's hair as well. They'd come from Australia. We don't know how they were lost, but we have reunited her with those papers.
Thank you, Sue. It's such valuable work that you and your volunteers are undertaking, helping to keep all those items safe for future generations. So now you know why I hold this organisation in such high esteem, as many of you will remember that I'm hooked on local history. It must be time to hear from our regular contributor, Toby Jacobs, this time read by Steve Thompson. You won't have heard his voice before, but I have, almost every day for the last 17 years, as he's my husband.
My favourite things. When Julie Andrews sang about her favourite things in The Sound of Music, she wasn't only talking about her penchant for running through alpine meadows. I do believe that kittens were mentioned, possibly brown paper, and definitely lederhosen. Improbably well-behaved children aside, the film does bring to mind the fact that we all have a selection of things we treasure, and that includes smells. How often have you been stopped in your track when a particular aroma calls to mind a memory from the past? It's powerful stuff. In this article, I'd like to share with you some of my favourite things related to my Boogle. Warning, this has been written in Smell-O-Vision. As the music got louder, the ride went faster. As the ride went faster, the music got louder. The waltzer was the place to be seen, and the men spinning the cars looked like they'd steal your granny. But I loved it. I am, of course, talking about all the fun of the fair. This curious mix of fear and fascination was an olfactory smorgasbord. You had the aroma of diesel from the generators, grease from the gears and cogs, onions sizzling on the hot plates, candy floss pink and sweet, and the smell of tobacco from the incongruous teddy boy picking your pockets. Every summer I would wait until I heard the sound of fairground blowing across Mitcham Common to my home. I would don my best 80s fashions and make the pilgrimage to Wonderland. Never was there a place so redolent of fun and menace in equal measure. So now, if I ever get a whiff of that heady combination of old denim, oil and caramelised sugar, I can close my eyes and be back there on that ride, age 13. Scream if you want to go faster! When Rod Stewart sang First Cut Is the Deepest, he may have been waxing lyrical about a thwarted relationship with yet another leggy blonde. Alternatively, the song could have been about his love of football and the joy of mowing the turf on his very own full-sized football pitch. To anyone who follows sports, the smell of freshly cut grass can evoke a powerful feeling. Whether it's soccer, tennis, golf, or in my place, cricket, the aroma can send one into paroxysms of delight. As the month of May approached, I knew that the first match of the season would soon be upon me. I had not previously had any interest in cricket, but I found myself living on my own and needed to find a reason to get out of the house. Luckily for me, Addicombe's Cricket Club was just around the corner, and it soon became my weekend destination of choice. Although only minutes from the hustle and bustle of central Croydon, this green oasis was the epitome of calm. They say there is nothing better than the sound of leather on willow, and they were right, whoever they were. I soon became a regular there, along with various other male singletons. We often joked that we looked like extras from The Last of the Summer Wine. I was a sort of modern-day Clegg. Come rain or shine, I would always be guaranteed a welcome at our favourite bench. There was Dave, George, Tony, and two Steves, my pals. Other spectators would drop in for a quick chat and then move on. One of the highlights of the day was tea. This was when the two teams stopped play and went into the clubhouse for something to eat and drink. We would circle the pavilion like buzzards riding the thermals, hoping for any leftovers, which there invariably were. The only downside to cricket is that it only lasts for 4 months, and come September we all said goodbye and didn't see each other until the following May. I left London in 2015, but I know that my old buddies are still occupying that bench, putting the world to rights. I can go back there any time. I just have to get a lungful of freshly mown grass, and I'm right back there. How's that? I ride a GS scooter with my hair cut neat. I wear my wartime coat in the wind and the sleet. These lines from the Who album Quadrophenia bring me into my final favourite fragrance, the smell of an Italian scooter. To the uninitiated, we're talking about Vespas and Lambrettas. And without getting too technical, they have a two-stroke engine, which is fast becoming a rare beast these days. As well as a delicious smell, they also have a unique sound. When gathered together en masse, they make for quite a sight. In the film version of this cult classic, the scooters take equal billing to the actors. Based around the infamous seaside crashes between mods and rockers in the 1960s, Quadrophenia tells the story of Jimmy, a mod from Shepherd's Bush. With great music, clothes and of course scooters, the film has gone down as one of Britain's best youth culture films. I caught the bug on an old VHS tape and I became hooked for the next 20 years. Obviously, I was destined to get a Vespa on my own, and so it was. Whenever I kick-started it and got a face full of exhaust fumes, I was Jimmy, riding around the streets of London or along the clifftops of Brighton. There's still a big Quadrophenia following now, and they even named an alleyway after it that featured in the film. To quote from the album again, "Ill-fitting clothes on, I blend in the crowd, fingers so clumsy, voice too loud, but I'm one."
Thank you, Toby, and to Steve for bringing his story to life. I'm a massive Who fan, and Quadrophenia is one of my favourite films, probably because, like Toby, I love all things mod, especially scooters. Let's welcome back Michelle with the answers to the quiz.
Hello. I've got the answers. They are: question one, a cooper makes wooden barrels. The craft is still practiced in whiskey distilleries, among other places, and the apprenticeship takes 4 years. Question two, working holiday, paid volunteer, and same difference are all oxymorons, a figure of speech that combines words with contradictory meanings. Question three. The gunpowder plot took place in November 1605. It was initially planned for the opening of Parliament in February that same year, but the ceremony was postponed due to an outbreak of the plague. Question four. Earl Grey tea is named after the second Earl Grey, who was British Prime Minister from 1830 to 1834. Question five. It's false. A typical cloud weighs around 1 million tons. Water's heavy, but clouds can float because they have a density around 0.4% lower than the air surrounding them. Not much, is it? Question six. Ely Cathedral, Cambridgeshire, is known as the Ship of the Fens, as it appears to float on a virtually flat 23-kilometre square island of clay. It has two towers, 166 metres, that's 215 feet, the other 52 metres, 170 feet high. Question seven. The Mellstock Choir go a-carolling and a-quarrelling at their neighbours' doors in Under the Greenwood Tree. Question 8. Bethlehem is a village in Carmarthenshire, West Wales. It was named after the village chapel. People used to visit in droves to get its name stamped on their Christmas cards. but I think post office changes may have brought that to a halt. Question 9. In the song Winter Wonderland, the snowman is named Parson Brown. And last but not least, question 10. Traditionally greeted by the audience with loud hissing, King Rat.
Oh no, it isn't.
Is the villain in Dick Whittington?
Oh no, he isn't.
Oh yes, he is.
No, he is not.
Thank you, Michelle. I think you might well have found yourself a new role. Now it's time for recent regular Richard Fawcett, concentrating on one of the other senses with heard melodies, unheard melodies.
Nowadays, I can struggle to recall yesterday afternoon, never mind days long past. However, enter magician Music to the rescue. Music played live, broadcast, or recorded on whatever medium, or on none, even if heard only in the mind, perhaps especially in the mind. Heard melodies are sweet, writes John Keats, but those unheard are sweeter. The same John Keats, however, hears the timeless nightingale whose song was heard in ancient days by emperor and clown. No surprise, after a lifetime's playing and listening to music, a background shared, moreover, with partner Heather. Our recorded music archive at home includes, to pick a random few, Sudbury Choral Society, with Heather singing soprano, performing African Sanctus under Brian Rose in Sudbury St. Peter's. The two of us playing folk on Radio Orwell. Own music tracks recorded by the boys, John and Joe. Mungo Jerry in the Summertime and Marvin Gaye through the Grapevine, teenage favourites of Heather's. Gustav Mahler, sundry song cycles and symphonies. Music not on old recordings includes Dorset Forehand Reel, Shepherd's Hay, Keel Row, Heather's own narrowboat reel. These dance tunes are melodies in the mind, the more so for being once firmly under fingers that played them for years, particularly with barn dance band Whirligig. Whirligig was a mostly family barn band comprising Heather, guitar, myself, fiddle, usually one or other or both of John and Joe, guitar or bass, or friends Gary or Jack Depping for them, Martin, melodeon, and John, caller. For a lengthy period, our bass was Phil. The band typically played village halls between the Waveney and the Thames. We went as far as Canvey, Diss, Over and Woodbridge, and as close by as Waldingfield, Pebmarsh and Assington. Several years in succession in Assington, a lovely fundraising gig on a farm where the annual hog roast was a delight for non-vegetarians. Heather, sadly, veggie. And of course, we played Sudbury, including several outings at the Granary and the Millennium Dance at the Town Hall, where our bass player was Guy. Sudbury gigs were naturally easy to get to and to get home from. Gigs farther afield mostly posed no problem, following Heather's planning, until the time caller John drove with his brand new sat-nav. I'm not sure about our destination that night, nor was John. We were in two cars. A text went to the second car. Have sat-nav. Maybe in Cape Town? Another gig, very late in the year for us, took us beyond Framlingham to Baddingham. Increasingly lost in the wet darkness, we gradually changed the name from Baddingham to Worsingham to Worstingham. Good gig, though. Our dances were always joyful events, enjoyed by young and old alike, but almost invariably sparked into life by youngsters, an exception occurring somewhere out beyond Cambridge, when the teenagers were banished from the dance hall to their own refreshments elsewhere. Hard going, that one. It wasn't all barn dances, though. Often, when Heather sang with Sudbury Choral or with St. Peter's Singers, I would join her in the orchestra. Several carol concerts in St. Peter's come to mind, in which Brian Swallow conducted his St. Peter's Singers and Juniors, in which a very young Joe sang. These always featured John Rutter's lovely carols and the much-loved Walking in the Air. The St. Peter's named in the choir's titles, by the way, is the one in Headingham. Special memories centre on Sudbury Choral Society and Messiah. Oh, and please, not the Messiah. I first played Messiah at school and later in King's College Chapel. We violins sat immediately in front of a line of King's own basses. As they opened the Amen chorus, we could feel their powerful sound waves beat against our backs. Top memory of Messiah, however, is a choir rehearsal of All We Like Sheep, perhaps the trickiest chorus in the work, I'm told by singers. But look at the words. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. Surely, in a religious work, you might think, the sheep will be called on to repent their waywardness. Conductor Brian Rose wanted his choir to make it clear that the sheep revelled in naughtiness. Heather thoroughly enjoyed that rehearsal. Oh my, how time flies, and I haven't mentioned Heather singing madrigals with Roger Glean, or the Sudbury Festival, or gigs we went to where the boys had their own bands, or our Station Road music shop, or Noah's Flood. Oh well, another time, perhaps.
Thank you, Richard. What an exceptionally easy-on-the-ear voice you have, and thank you for sharing with us your musical memories. I'm sure there'll be another opportunity to fit in those other ones you mentioned in a future edition. The music theme leads us nicely into the final piece for this edition. We can't end this recording without addressing the elephant in the room. Yes, Christmas. And so I'm going to have to include something Christmassy to get you in the mood. What could be more fitting than a piece of music? But not just any piece, oh no. We have a very special someone choosing and providing the music for you in this edition. Mr. Roger Glean. If you know Sudbury, then you'll know of Roger through his teaching, history talks and St. Peter's Church, to name but a few. He is also an outstanding organist who will obligingly operate the organ here at the Hive Live, where we record the magazine. But before he does, Roger, can you tell us a little about the organ and the piece of music you've chosen to play for us?
Well, truly, the organ was built in 1911, so it's over 200, it's over 100, I'll start that again. Okay, so it's over 100 years old and still going. It's one of the loveliest organs that I ever play. It has many beautiful sounds on it. And why the piece of music? Well, we wish you a happy Christmas, and I'd like to wish everybody who's listening to this a wonderful, happy Christmas time.
you've enjoyed my first foray into presenting, and it just leaves time for all the members of News Talk Sudbury to wish you a
Happy Christmas!
2024 brings peace and goodwill to all.